Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We are back, and thank you for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. Call that number, and we'll get you on the air with your comment or question. 888-914-9149. That's sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. So I got an email just a few minutes ago from a lady who said, I'm offended by your show.
All right, longer. Let's do it.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to love this. Cyrus, you're going to love this.
Oh, I'm waiting.
You're mentioned.
I'm a little nervous.
Okay, so this is from Angela, and subject line, Patrick, I'm offended by your show. Just kidding. Ha ha. I just knew that would get Cyrus's attention, which it did.
It did. It worked. Way to go.
She says, anyway, I'm desperate for an answer to a few questions. How do I explain to a non-Catholic, my husband's friends, etc., why they can't accept the Eucharist if they come to Mass with me? Also, should I refrain from communion so as not to leave them sitting in the pew alone? I'm just trying to avoid an awkward situation and not turn them off from ever attending Mass with me again. Love you both, Angela. Well, thank you, Angela. And lots of beautiful love coming back to you. I would do this. I would say that the Lord Jesus Christ is truly present under the appearances of bread and wine in the Mass, in the Eucharist. And the Bible, St. Paul speaking here, the Bible is really clear that if you are not in the state of grace and or if you do not recognize or discern the body, that you should not receive communion because, as St. Paul says there in the first case, you are guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. That's another way of saying murder. And in the second instance, if you don't recognize or discern the body, then you are eating and drinking judgment or damnation upon yourself. So you want to begin reading in verse 23, and St. Paul describes this. And you could point out that this prohibition from receiving communion for either or both of these two causes, it's not just for non-Catholics. It is for non-Catholics, but it's also for Catholics who are in the state of serious sin. Or, I mean, I think this is less likely, but somebody who doesn't recognize or discern the body. And that means a couple different things. That means certainly recognizing the real presence of Jesus in what appears to be a host of bread and what appears to be a chalice of wine. There are some Catholics maybe who don't, you know, they just don't believe that. Well, this would apply to them. Or somebody who goes further and espouses some heresy, like saying that absolutely is not the body and blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. That would be a heresy. So in any case, the point is the Bible and St. Paul speaking here is saying that for your own spiritual welfare, don't receive communion when you're in these situations. And he says, that is why, verse 30, many of you are weak and ill, and some of you have died, or some have died. Died? What do you mean? Well, I think some people actually did die. Like, they received communion in the state of mortal sin and maybe dropped dead. You may say, oh, come on. Well, I don't know. Take a look at Acts chapter, what is it, Acts chapter 10? Got to go back and look at it, but it's Ananias and Sapphira. They were two early Christians. And they, as the people were doing in those days, the Christians, they were selling their lands and their homes and their stuff, and they were liquidating the proceeds and then turning it over to the apostles to be distributed to all of the different, you know, Christians in the community as a way to have everything in common and so on and so forth. And it's in Acts chapter 5, excuse me. And so this couple, you know, you say, oh, it's preposterous to think that somebody died because they received Holy Communion in the state of mortal sin. Well, in Acts chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira sold some of their possessions, but not all of them. And then when they brought them, and they did not come into the room at the same time. So Ananias comes in first. Hey, here's the stuff that we sold. We're giving. St. Peter says, did you give all of it? And he said, yeah, gave all of it. Why? And he says, well, because you really didn't give all of it. You're lying to God. You're lying to us. And you're lying to God. And when Ananias, hearing these words, he fell down and breathed his last. In other words, he dropped dead on the spot. And we're told in verse 5, great fear came upon all those who heard these things. So they saw this guy come in. They didn't know that he was lying, but St. Peter did. And he reveals the lie, and the guy dies. So then, as they're carrying him out, they're like picking up this dead guy, and they're going out stage right with the body of Ananias. His wife comes traipsing in. She doesn't know that her husband, you know, I mean, a few hours went by, but the fact is his body was removed. And not long after that, she shows up. She doesn't know what happened, and he asks her the same question. And she too lies. And so she too drops dead. Then and there, she lies to the Holy Spirit, she lies to St. Peter, and she dies. So I don't think it's far-fetched to say that it's possible, as we read in Matthew or 1 Corinthians chapter 11, that there were people who received Holy Communion unworthily and then died. Now, you don't hear about that happening nowadays. I think there'd be a lot of dead people nowadays if that were the case. But the Lord is not dealing in that stern manner with his people now, but it seems that he did at that time. So back to your email, what I would say, Angela, is share that passage with your husband and your friends and say, you know, this is not intended to like keep people away from the Eucharist. It's not intended to be exclusive, like this is for us and you can't have it kind of thing. Rather, it's a form of protecting people, including Catholics who are chronically in the state of serious sin, or they're just in the state of serious sin, and they know they shouldn't receive communion. So it's a protective measure. And if people see it the way it's really intended, hopefully they'll recognize, well, I want to be ready to receive the Eucharist. I want to believe in the Eucharist. I want to believe that Jesus said, my flesh is real food and my blood is real drink. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has life within him. He who doesn't eat my flesh and doesn't drink my blood does not have life within him. And why wouldn't you want to receive Holy Communion? So hopefully, Angela, hopefully when in your gentle, tactful way of explaining this, you can help your husband and the others see this is an invitation for you to receive this gift that the Lord wants you to have, but it's so powerful because it's the Lord himself under the appearance of bread and wine. It's not a symbol of him. Well, I should say this. It's not merely a symbol of him. It is a symbol, but it's more than a symbol because it's also the reality as well. And the Lord wants them, your husband and your friends, etc., to have this as his immense, rich gift to us, but we have to be properly prepared to receive it. I would propose that you do something like that. And I hope that's helpful to you. Cyrus, I think you said you had an email, or can we get back to the phones?
Yeah, this is good. This will be quick. This is from Nancy, not your Nancy, but another Nancy. And she says, hey, Patrick, love your show. Listen all the time. I'm a better Catholic because of you. You asked a caller who is struggling with scrupulosity if she had a pen handy to jot down some information. And she said, yes. I'm always astounded how almost every time you ask a caller if he or she has a pen, he or she says yes. A pen? What's a pen? I think I might have a vague memory of that. Take care, Patrick, and thanks for everything. And when you call into the show and you're going to ask a question, have a pen and paper handy.
That makes sense. Yeah. And who's that from, Nancy?
That's from Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy. Well, I don't know how to account for it. I often do not have a pen on me, so I must be out of sync with all of our wonderful callers. I just typically put notes in my phone. That to me is the easiest way to do it. But maybe when I say, do you have a pen handy, they know what I mean. And it could be that they're just putting a note in the phone. Maybe. Well, thanks for that email. I appreciate that. Oh, so real quick, Cyrus, here's another one. This is from Bill. Patrick, you offended me. Haha, just kidding. I think you're awesome. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate that. I think we've started something here. Let's go to Pete in Miami. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning. My question is, I'll be traveling to China soon, okay. And I wanted to see if I could get your take on what the current status of the Catholic Church is in communist China, availability, what should I do?
Well, here's the thing. So in China, there is what's known as the Patriotic Catholic Church, and it's a creature of the communist Chinese government, and they control it. They name the men who will be bishops. They decide who will be ordained a priest. They very vigorously control it. It's kind of like a petting zoo for Chinese Catholics that they control. Now, in the last dozen years or so, the Vatican has signed some agreements with the Chinese communist government about this and has offered some recognition for, you know, bishops and things like that. It's still a big mess because prior to that time, the Catholic Church did not recognize the so-called Patriotic Catholic Church and did not in any way accede to the communist demands to be able to name the bishops and control this and all that. So there was, alongside this, and had been even before this was set up, the underground Catholic Church. And they would meet secretly. They would have clandestine masses and things like that. Well, the underground Catholic Church has been heavily persecuted for all these many decades since the rise of communism in China in the 1940s. So it's been a real difficulty and struggle. There have been many martyrs and such. So now, if you were to go to China, you could find the Patriotic Chinese Church offering mass. And I think I would need to do a bit of research to double check, but I think that the Vatican has said that you would fulfill your Sunday obligation if you went there to one of those masses. I personally, however, would find it distasteful. And I would not want to go to the Patriotic Chinese Church. I would rather seek out the underground church. And I wouldn't know how to go about doing that because I've never been to China. So in your travels, I would say, and I don't know what to recommend to you because I don't know how to go about it, how you would locate them. But as I understand it, and you can go to the Vatican website and find these agreements that were reached between the Vatican and the Chinese government. But I believe there you will find the information about making your Sunday obligation if you went to a patriotic church.
Okay. I'll look into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it would be difficult to find the underground church as they are underground and probably not English speaking or anything to that extent.
That's true. But don't forget though that that if you were to go to Mass in any language, you're still going to Mass. Whether you understand it is a different question. It's obviously ideal when you can understand it.
Sure.
But there is a good book. I have this. It's been a long time since I've read it, but it's called Hegemon, China's Plan to Dominate Asia and the World. It's by Stephen Mosher, Mosher. It'd be a good book to read. He's written a number of different books on the topic. He has another book called Bully of Asia, and another one called The Devil and Communist China. So he's, as you can see, he's a critic of the Chinese government, but he's very informed, very knowledgeable. And so any of these books by Stephen Mosher might be good reading for you before you go over there.
Perfect. I just jotted it down with my pen.
Okay.
And last thing, do you suggest doing like an online mass to fulfill my obligation?
Yeah, well, that doesn't fulfill your obligation to go to watch Mass online. That's nice when you can do it. And it's good to be able to do that, but it doesn't fulfill one's obligation. That can only be fulfilled in person. But so what I would suggest is before you go on your trip, and how long will your trip last, by the way?
I'll be there for 2 Sundays. So.
Okay, so 2 weeks or the better part of 2 weeks? Okay. What I would do is ask your pastor for a dispensation due to travel in a communist country where the possibility of going to Mass is pretty slim. And he has the authority to commute or dispense your obligation. And you do kind of have a sort of an automatic dispensation or at least a commutation of the duty to go to Mass on Sunday if it's beyond your control. But in a case like this, I think I would ask for that specific granting of that dispensation by your pastor. And he has the authority to do that.
That is very interesting. Great advice. Thank you, Patrick.
All right. Well, hope you have safe travels and
Thank you.
Come back in one piece and come back and tell everybody what you saw when you were there.
Sounds good. I'll be listening to you over there.
Okay. Sounds good, Pete. Thank you. I think we can get away quickly or get quickly to Nancy in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
You sort of just answered my question. So I have a daughter who's going to be starting medical school, and it's about her dispensation for Mass as well. You know, there are just going to be times that, you know, she's concerned about it, where her dad and I are concerned about it, you know, as practicing Catholics. I know that she's going to make every effort to get to Mass, but, you know, medical school is complicated, and you don't
what
have a lot of control over... You know,
what would prevent that?
Well, I mean, I think when she's, you know, when she's, particularly when she's a resident, right? I'm thinking, you know, you work long hours and she may very well be working, you know, Saturday night into and through Sunday morning.
Yeah. So in a case like that, she would have a reasonable excuse. So if she's prevented from attending either the vigil Mass on Saturday evening or Mass sometime on Sunday, then she has no choice. And if it's something beyond your control, like that would be, then you're not committing a sin by missing Mass. If she was just saying, well, I have to work all day Sunday, but I could get to Mass on Saturday evening, but I'm pretty tired. No, that's not a good reason. But if she's prevented from going, she just can't go, well, then her obligation is not, you know, if she misses Mass, she's not committing a sin because she has no power over that, right?
And if she knows her schedule ahead of time, right, she knows that that's going to be, is it better for her to seek dispensation, to say, you know, to her pastor, listen, I'm not going to be able to go because this is my schedule, or is that not necessary?
Well, in her case, no, I don't think it would be necessary because if she just can't go, there's no need for dispensation. But like, let's say that you had a little baby at home. And the baby is sick and needs you, and you can't get to Mass because you have to be there with the baby. Well, you don't need a dispensation because it's beyond your control. But the fellow I just talked to is going to China. In theory, he could go to Mass. He could find a Mass and go to Mass. But this is where, given those circumstances, I recommended the dispensation just because of the weirdness of that situation over there. It's not beyond his control to go to Mass. But it's not...
Got it.
Under the circumstances, kind of odd. So as far as your daughter's concerned, I have a feeling that, you know, given the countless men and women who have gone through medical school and residency and practiced medicine, you know, they figured out ways to get to Mass when they could. They did the best they could.
Right.
And I think that's what the Lord's asking of her. Just do the best you can. Make every effort. And if it's impossible, well, these things happen.
Great. That's good. I will pass that message on to her. Thank you so much.
Okay. You're welcome. You know, I'm thinking of all those Catholic explorers and settlers who 200-300 years ago were moving from the eastern part of the U.S. into the Wild West, like Ohio. And they were going into places where they would never see a priest for months, if not years. And they didn't commit a sin by not going to Mass on Sunday because they couldn't. Think of it that way. If you have the ability to go, go. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at CharityMobile.com. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at CharityMobile.com.
Looky, Ma, I got me a radio show.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
That's what I'm talking about. Welcome back, 888-914-9149. You call that number, we'll get you on the air with your comment or question, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Charles now in Cerritos, California. Hi, Charles.
Hello. I have two questions for you.
Alrighty.
The first is, last month we heard that CVS and Walgreens started selling with a fresh stone.
How old are you?
10.
10 years old. And do you know what mifepristone is?
It's the most used abortion pill in the country at this moment.
Yeah, you know your stuff. Okay. So, all right.
Yeah, so now I've heard that helping to procure an abortion would be a mortal sin. So does that mean then that if you're the guy who works there and you're the guy handing the pills to the woman, are you committing a mortal sin?
Yes, I do believe you are, because you're directly participating. Now, it can be, I want to just be real careful here. So you can be participating in a way that's unintended. So let's say, I'm going to use a couple of parallels and we'll come back to the guy in the store, okay? Mm-hmm. You might be the UPS driver. Or the driver of the big truck that brings all the product to the store once a week. And you're bringing those abortion pills to the store, but you don't know it. You don't know what's in the truck. And you're not committing a sin if you're participating in that way. You might be, the 16-year-old stock boy who's stocking things on the shelves, and you're just trying to get the stuff out of the boxes and up on the shelves as fast as you can. You don't even know what this is, but you're putting it out on the shelf or on the peg. And you're not committing a sin because you don't even really know what these things are. You just know that your job is to put them on the shelf and move on to the next thing. But let's say that you're the pharmacist and you do know what that is. You do know what it does. And a woman comes in to pick up her prescription and you fill the prescription knowing what this thing does. You are now committing a sin because you are directly involved, at least at that level, and you're cooperating with this. So the person whom you're talking about, I'm assuming you're talking about somebody like a tech or somebody working at the pharmacy or even the pharmacist who knows what these are, knows what they do, and says, well, got to make a paycheck, so I'm just going to do this, and I'm not really going to think anything about it. I would say, yes, that would be a sinful activity because you know better, and you're putting something else higher than doing what you know you should do, which is not participate.
Okay, so then if you're working there and you know that things like that could happen or will happen, would it be morally permissible to keep working there?
In some cases, no. And I think the morally permissible part, you're asking really good questions, Charles. I think where it becomes an urgent issue is when it happens. So if you're, let's say that you're going to work at a pharmacy and you get a job and you know that at some point this could happen, but it hasn't happened yet. I don't think it would be immoral for you to work there, just working and doing normal work that doesn't require something like this. But if it gets to the point where you're now being asked to do something like that, that's where you have to make a decision and say, am I going to knowingly go along with this, or am I going to look for a different job? And that's a difficult thing for people who obviously, everybody needs to eat and pay the rent. So everybody needs to work and make money. And that's a very difficult choice. But I'll ask you to think about something like this, Charles. What if somebody said to you, listen, unless you renounce Jesus Christ, we're going to kill you? That's about as difficult as you could possibly imagine. It is as difficult as you could possibly imagine, because to give up your life, I mean, there's nothing higher or greater than you can give up. I mean, you can give up a job, but that's lower down the list of important things, right?
Yeah.
So to give up your life means to be a martyr, and to say, I would rather die than sin against Jesus in that way. And that's how martyrs are made. So if you think of it this way, if you ever were in a situation where the job you had, the people, you know, your boss or whatever, were requiring you to do something that you knew was immoral and that you couldn't do it without committing a sin, to give up your job is a lot less difficult than give up your life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a form of martyrdom at a lower level. But as Jesus said, this is something to think about, because you're 10 years old and you don't have to deal with these issues yet, but at some point you will. Jesus said, if you're faithful in little things, you will be faithful in big things. But if you're unfaithful in little things, you'll be unfaithful in big things. Meaning that if you grow up and learn to say no to something that would get in the way of your relationship with God, even though you might want that, or you might enjoy that, if you say, no, I won't do that because it will interfere with my relationship with God. Those are like the little things that Jesus is talking about. And if it should ever happen that somebody puts a gun to your head and says, you either renounce Jesus or we're going to kill you, it'll be easier for you to say no then, because you've learned how to say no to all the little things. Or to look at it the other side, if you're faithful in doing what's right time after time after time after time, when something really big comes along, you're going to be faithful in that area as well. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
And then I have one other question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Which, this probably doesn't happen very often, but it could. Say a transgender man who identifies as a woman marries a woman or wants to marry a woman who identifies as a man, and they're both Catholic, then could the church validly bless their marriage? Because it would still be between a man and a woman, but in a very strange way.
Mm-hmm. So if you have a so-called transgender man who's actually a woman presenting herself as a man, and a so-called transgender man, I'm sorry, woman who's actually a man presenting himself as a woman, I don't think that the church would permit them to get married because of these deep psychological disorders. In other words, in order to be validly married, you have to be sufficiently mature and sufficiently, you know, plugged into reality so that you can have a marriage that's based on truth and openness to life and whatnot. So these lifestyle choices would suggest to me that these people are not capable of entering into a valid marriage because of these psychological problems. So I think if the priest were to say, no, I can't do that, it would be for that reason.
All right.
And here's the thing. Just the fact that they are male and female doesn't exhaust the requirements to have a valid marriage. So you're right. They are married. They are male and female. So that part's true. But there's more to it than that in order to have a valid marriage. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So now you are a very sharp young man, I must say.
Thank you.
Do you and your parents talk about these types of things around the dinner table? Because you're obviously a very deep thinker.
Not much, but what we do when I ask if I can call you about them.
Yeah, do that. Call, even if your parents say it's okay. Have you ever thought about being a priest when you grow up?
Yes.
Good. I hope you will continue. Are you familiar with the Norbertine Fathers at St. Michael's Abbey?
Oh, yes. I've gone to the summer camp 3 times.
Excellent. Well, stay close to those guys, because they're very, very good. And if you have any inkling of wanting to be a priest, I would check in with them when the time comes. It's good that you went to summer camp. I went to summer camp there a million years ago.
Yeah.
And I really loved it.
The food's better now.
Good. Oh, you've heard me talk about that.
Yeah.
It wasn't so good back in those days. I'm glad it's gotten better. Well, yeah. Thank you, Charles.
Yeah, bye.
Did we cover it? I like your style, dude.
I think Charles is ready to hang up the phone. Sharp kid, though. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, they don't get any sharper than that. 10 years no. old.
Were you talking about mifepristone when you were 10 years old, Cyrus?
No, I wasn't.
The morning.
No, I think I was thinking about Star Wars. And that consumed.
You're still thinking about Star Wars.
I am. It's true.
Sharp kid. Well, kudos to his parents for raising such a sharp lad. We'll go to Christofferson now in Seattle. Good morning, Christofferson.
Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
Just a quick question on, just to clarify, marital obligation. Okay. I've read some articles that it's a sin if you do that for pleasure other than, performing your marital obligations other than procreating.
No, that's not true. The marital act, so let's take a step back. And this, by the way, is not a topic suitable for children. So parents, please, if you are in Houston, California, or Traverse City, Michigan, or some other place where I know that there are children listening, turn the radio down for a few minutes, okay? Fair warning, ready, steady, go. So the proper context for marital intimacy is in marriage, as you know. And it is proper for married couples to engage in marital intimacy. So it's something that God ordained for their pleasure. And it's not sinful to enjoy the pleasure, even if you're not intending to have a child, you know, to procreate, so long as you are not doing anything that would tweak or distort the marriage act so that it's incapable of being open to life. So that's the bottom line there, is the church says you as a married couple, you have a right to this. It actually glorifies God as a renewal of the marriage covenant in your flesh, that marital intimacy and the pleasure that comes from it, you have a right to it. Now, you don't have an unrestricted absolute right to it. That could be hedonism. And the church, of course, doesn't say that you can fall into the sin of hedonism purely for the sake of pleasure. But what is necessary for a married couple is simply that the act culminate in a way that is possible for procreation to take place. They don't have to be wanting children. They don't have to be saying, well, this is the time when we can very likely conceive a child, and we'll only make use of this benefit in marriage for this purpose. No, the church does not require it. God does not require it. You're free to engage in this, you know, obviously within certain limitations, respecting your wife, etc. And it would be an error to say that you can only engage in marital intimacy for the express purpose of then and there trying to procreate. That would be a serious error.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for clarifying that, because, you know, I've been talking to my wife and, you know, went to confession and said that, hey, you know, I did, you know, this sin of lust twice last week, and it just like didn't feel right to me. So I just had to call. Thank you for clarifying that.
When you say that, do you mean the Marriage Act itself or something on your own?
The Marriage Act itself.
Let's pause on this for a second here. I don't know any of the inner workings. I don't need to know any of the inner workings, but if your wife told you that because you engaged in marital intimacy simply because you love her and you want to be with her, that that's somehow a sin, that's absolutely false. That's not a sin. It's not a sin. It would be a sin if the couple were to engage in marital intimacy in a way that didn't result in an act that could be open to life. That would be a sin. That's true. But assuming that that's not what happened, assuming that this was a normal example of marital intimacy, there is no sin in that at all. Now, obviously, you have to govern your thoughts. And I mean, it is possible to commit the sin of lust, but ordinarily, husband and wife enjoying this benefit of marriage are not at all committing the sin of lust. This is mutual self-giving. So if it's the case that you're, I don't want to pry, but I'll just put it this way. If it's the case that your wife thinks that every time you engage in marital intimacy that you're somehow committing a sin, she's misunderstanding the church's teaching on this issue. It's possible to commit a sin, but not likely given the circumstances. Mm. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Patrick, there was a line in the Bible that says, I forgot who it was, and he spilled his, you know.
Yeah, it's Onan, you know, and it's in Genesis chapter 38.
So is that a sin?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you read Genesis 38, is that what happened in this case you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, yes, that's a sin.
That's one form of our family planning.
Well, get rid of that form because that is a serious sin. Stop doing that.
Yes.
Okay, so that's a missing piece of the puzzle that I wasn't aware of. I was assuming that the act was taking place normally. So don't do that anymore. That is a serious sin.
Yes, that's what we're trying to do, and it's a little hard.
Yeah, so what you do is you, one thing you can do, first of all, you can't do that.
So right.
Stop that. And if your wife is saying that's a sin, well, she's right. Okay, she's absolutely right about that. When you engage in this good of marriage, is the thing to remember is it has to be completed in the way that would be possible for life to be transmitted. If it's completed in any other way than that, then it would be sinful. If you're doing it intentionally, it would be sinful. If it's a barrier or a chemical or a drug or an action like what you're talking about, it would be sinful if it's intentional. So within marriage, as long as the act is completed naturally and you're not intending or trying to do anything that could prevent the act from being open to life, then you're okay. But don't do that anymore because that is a serious sin.
Okay. All right.
Are you familiar with NFP?
Yes.
That can help
I'm a nurse,
you.
So.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, that can help you. In other words, if you're, if the concern is, I know we have to go to a break, but 30 seconds more. If the concern is your wife's health, spacing children, dire financial situation, you're living in Gaza and there's a war going, you know, whatever the situation may be, there are times when it would be permissible for you to space children by following NFP. And I don't need to explain it to you because you know what it is. But that's something that you can make use of in a moral, illicit way if the circumstances require it. So look into that if you think of that. But definitely what you're talking about, don't do that anymore because that is a serious sin. All right, quick break and we'll be back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show. If you want to send me an email, patrick@relevantradio.com. And the number to call, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. info@charitymobile.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
So if somebody was confused about that last conversation, read Genesis 38, the story of Onan, and you should understand at that point what that was all about.
Okay? Hey, an email just came in in regards to every once in a while you'll say, you know, ready, steady, go, and that's what this is about. Dear Patrick, I always appreciate Patrick's warning when mature topics come up, especially when listening in the car and all my children are a captive audience.
Oh.
But even more appreciative is the attentive listening this warning gets from my teenagers. If I'm listening in the kitchen, for example, and my kids are playing elsewhere in the house and this warning is heard, my teenagers are instantly interested and even make a special trip to the kitchen to hear Patrick address the juicy topics.
Now, imagine that. Imagine teenagers being interested in such things. Wow.
Yeah, I thought that would amuse you. Melanie in Arkansas.
Well, thanks, Melanie. I wonder how many kids we're talking about. At least two. So
that would have been me. That's every teenager. It's like, oh, hey, yeah. You can't, we don't want you to hear that.
There's
there's
a kind of radar now I'm built listening. In. And, you know, I really am very attentive to the fact we don't want the little ones especially to hear about things that are not appropriate for them. They don't need to know about such things. As the kids get older into the teen years and things like that, I mean, like it or not, we live in a society where it's far more likely that they will be, at least in some general sense, aware of these things that, you know, you can say, I wish they weren't, but society being what it is, it often happens. So I do try to exercise special caution here. It's not foolproof, but I hope. Now, what's the name of the lady who, Melanie, is that right?
Yeah, Melanie.
Yeah, well, I hope, Melanie, that when your teenagers are actually listening in, when I give that parental advisory, that the topics and the way I discuss them, I hope, is helpful to them and helpful to you and your husband as parents, and not making a headache for you in dealing with them. So if you're okay with them listening to those parental advisory conversations, great. Okay, good.
You know, I have another one here. Earlier, yeah. You were talking about always having a pen handy.
Yeah, right.
So this is from Thomas in Tucson, and he says, a pen handy, always. This is our daily master class in facts, faith, and fun. Who are these unprepared students who not have their Bible, catechism, and notebook and journals at the ready? Come on, man.
Come on, man. Well, yeah, that's cool. I appreciate that. I want to give as much by way of, follow-on resources like books and things like that as I can. And I've learned a great deal, and many of the books, if not most of them, that I refer people to on this program are books that I have benefited from. So for what it's worth, I think these books are very helpful. So check it out. 888-914-9149. Here's a note that comes in from Anonymous listening in Tejas. Daughter engaged and planning to marry a man who does not believe in God. The daughter's 30, a devout Catholic, prays. This is interesting. Devout Catholic who prays 4 decades of the rosary every day. Why not 5? Why not pray the whole rosary? And I know a whole, quote unquote, whole rosary would be for the traditional rosary, sorrowful, glorious, and joyful mysteries. And if you add in the luminous mysteries, but that's not what I'm talking. I'm just, 5 decades of the rosary. But in any case, telling me about the daughter and her devotion to the faith. She wants to get married to a man who does not believe in God. She has been sleeping over at his place. Sometimes she stays there for weeks. She told us that the man wants to talk to my husband and me about marrying our daughter. We told her we can't give our blessings and can't entrust her to a person who does not believe in God. Well, that's part of the problem, but she mentioned that he does believe in a God, but not the Catholic God. He agreed to have her bring up the kids Catholic and the Catholic Church wedding. We need guidance because whenever we talk to her about the importance of God above everything, implication of marriage to a non-believer, she says, I know, I'm aware of it. So Anonymous says, what can we do besides a lot of prayers? Thank you. Well, I think that your husband is the one who needs to take the lead on this. He's the father. He's her protector. Granted, she's 30 years old and she's out of the house and she's a mature woman on her own, etc. But he's still her father. And I'll tell you what, if that guy were to ask me to give permission to marry my daughter, I would refuse it. I would. And you're saying, oh, come on. No, I would. And here's why. I would say, if you don't respect my daughter enough to not be shacking up with her, if I can't trust you to make the right decision on something like that, I don't know that I can trust you on a whole lot of other issues. So no, you don't have my permission. I hope you don't force the issue. But if you want me to rethink this, if you want me as her father to consider saying yes to you, I mean, they can get married on their own if they want to. They don't, you know, it's not like you have to have the father's permission. But if he's, if he wants it, if he wants my blessing, I would say, no, you cease this immoral activity with my daughter, respect her, stop using her, and get your act together, and then we'll talk. And if he says, you know, your dad's a square, your dad, you know, what an old fogey or whatever, I would say, okay, you know, I'm not going to give you my blessing. I'm not going to give you my blessing if this is the kind of guy you are, because I don't want that kind of a guy as the quote-unquote husband for my beloved daughter, even though she's at fault too. She knows better. I mean, Anonymous is saying that she prays the rosary every day and she listens to podcasts, Catholic podcasts, and she reads Catholic resources and she goes to confession. Well, then she's living a double life then. And I don't see how you can do both. I mean, if she's living with this guy off and on, you know, staying the night, staying two nights, staying a week, and it seems pretty obvious what's going on there, how do you do that and pray the rosary every day? I don't get that.
Come on, man.
Exactly. So something's not quite right there. And so that would be my advice. Just your husband, if he takes the lead on this, and I believe he should, he just tell the guy how it is. You know, listen, we love our daughter. We want her to be happy. You may or may not be the right guy for her. If you don't believe in God, that's another strike against you right there, because how on earth do you expect her to have a kind of unity with you that ideally every marriage should have if you can't even agree about God? And by the way, there is no such thing as the Catholic God or that God or this God. There's only God. Anything else doesn't exist or is a demon, you know, that is masquerading as a God. You either believe in God or you don't. And if you don't believe in God, then I don't think you're a good candidate for my daughter, because she believes in God, even if she doesn't always act like that. And I'm here as her father to try to protect her and do what I can to help her. She's 30 years old now, so she's her own woman, but I'm here to protect her and help her move into a marriage when the time comes with a man who will likewise protect her and be unified with her. And if you don't both believe in God, that's not going to happen. And all the happy talk about raising the kids Catholic and all the happy talk about, you know, she can do what she wants, that looks good on paper, but usually, most of the time, it doesn't pan out. And I don't want a high-functioning atheist daughter, if she gets married to you and turns out she loses her faith. So, nope, sorry, I'm not going to give you my blessing. Now, it doesn't mean that they may not go forward with this, but it also means that you may have a realistic shot, or your husband and you may have a realistic shot in getting this guy's mind right. Maybe. I don't know. It's hard to say. But I would resist the temptation to go along to get along. And by golly, as the father, I would definitely make this guy's life miserable if he was trying to marry my daughter and he was persistent. I would be right there making his life miserable until either he left or he got his mind right and did the right thing. Now, I realize that that's, you know, a binary, either or, and often it doesn't happen as an either or outcome. There could be third, fourth, fifth different outcomes, but that's what I would be aiming for. So that's my take. I hope that's helpful. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Molly in Green Bay now. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
I'm following up on an emailer that you had messaged or read on the air earlier about when do you give up on bringing someone back to the faith. I'm having an issue with my husband and bringing him back to the faith. We're actually both married only 3 years now. We both come from a divorce and annulment, and now we're back married together. This is both our second marriages. And he was, you know, practicing the faith at the time. And, but now, you know, within the past year, he's like, he doesn't believe, says he doesn't believe in the papacy and all the man-made rules. Mm. And he only believes in the Bible and what Jesus said. And so therefore he doesn't believe in it, that he needs to go to church or go to confession.
Is he hanging out with a Protestant friend, or does he have Protestant colleagues at work, or has he been sort of drifting in that direction? Because this is not normal thinking for a Bible-believing Catholic. So it sounds like some kind of outside influence is going on here.
Well, I would say the people at his work really aren't that religious at all, so I don't think it's coming from there. I know that he does watch a lot of YouTube videos, so I don't know, somewhere along the way that he got, you know,
he's
is
being
believing
radicalized.
In those things.
I have a few thoughts on this and maybe a couple of questions too, Molly. We have to take a break. Do you mind holding for a minute?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll take a quick time out. We'll come back. YouTube is definitely a factor in a lot of people becoming radicalized and disoriented and losing their faith, because if they're not really firm in what they believe and understand what they believe, you can be very easily influenced by persuasive sounding arguments on YouTube. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And I have some suggestions on how you can address some of those specific issues, but we'll do that on the other side, Molly. So please stand by and I'll come back to you right after this. The number to call to be on the air, 888-914-9149. We have a line or two open, so give it a shot. 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.